This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 297 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by two terrific co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog and other places,
too. Well, good evening.
Too. Hey, Rob.
Yeah. Well, good. I didn't mean to talk over you there, Max, but I'm just so excited because we've got so many things going on tonight. Of course, nothing here in Chicago, but all on the show. So this ought to be fun.
We do have a lot to pack in this episode, and so that's going to make it exciting, and we'll try to move along pretty quickly. And so let me introduce David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Hey, Rob. Hey, Max. It's that week again. You know, the one where I have to wish you a happy birthday and you have to wish me a happy birthday?
That's right. Happy birthday, David.
On that note, let's keep going because we've got a lot of work to do.
All right. So you're just going to skip past the numbers, right?
Oh, yeah. We don't mention the numbers.
No.
Okay.
I'm still the baby, so it doesn't matter.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is May Kay Beeler. Oh, May Kay, she's kind of hard to introduce because she's done so many things. May Kay's a pilot, a CFII. She's the AOPA Airport Support Network volunteer for KGSO. Longtime member of the 99s, International Organization of Women Pilots. She's a television show host and author. Oh, my gosh. She's into skydiving, the Air Race Classic. It goes on and on. The Diva Flight Experience. It's more than enough for a lifetime, May Kay. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Max and Rob and Dave. It's great to be here. And happy birthday. Are you guys May birthdays? Is that the deal?
That's right. We are.
Well, happy birthday, and thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, now, you've written a book titled Buccaneer, The Provocative Odyssey of Jack Reed, Adventurer, Drug Smuggler, and Pilot Extraordinaire. It's an interesting book, May Kay, about a really fascinating man.
It is. And it's something if you were to tell me 10, 20 years ago that I would do this in my lifetime, that, oh my gosh, I'd say there's no way in the world I would ever write a book, let alone a book about a drug smuggler, an infamous one at that. It was the longest-running drug trial in U.S. history. Jack was the co-defendant of a famous drug lord. We're going to talk about all that coming up. A fascinating story with a twist of fate ending. So I'm hoping to tempt our listeners to go out and buy the book, because whether you love adventure or love stories, and it's all true crime, I think you'll really enjoy the book.
And I'm not going to spoil it by tipping the hand on the ending. We're going to keep it. No teasers here.
Okay, thank you, Max.
All right, first, though, we're going to start with some current aviation news and topics. We've got first quarter earnings. They're out for the U.S. airlines. We'll talk about the possibility of an all-aviation TV channel.
Yay!
Yeah, and that's right. And the Dutch scramble against the Russian bomber. And we also have a 1956 aviation accident that gets landmark status. Also coming up, David, airplane of the week. What have we got?
We're finishing up with the P3 Orion, the weird, wacky, and wonderful ones.
Fantastic. And in this week's Australia Desk report, the boys talk about a second Sydney airport and a Virgin Atlantic flight that squawks 7,500 on approach to Bali. That's going to be interesting. Also coming up, Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob, what are we looking at this time?
Well, this week I think we're going to call the spot a solution in search of a problem, and it has to do with our friends at the FAA, and they really pulled a stupid one this time. But I don't want to give the ending away.
The FAA did something stupid?
Yes, I know. I know it's hard to believe.
Okay.
Yes.
Is this where I'm supposed to say drink?
Yeah, I know. We have a drinking game, an FAA drinking game over at the UAV Digest podcast because we mention them so often. But back to this show, in Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment, he's going to talk with Frances Peters from Aviation Platform about the KLM Air France Group. And let's see, we have some listener recordings as well as some listener mail. So that's a lot of stuff. Why don't we get started right away? Is everyone ready?
Hey, it sounds like a great show. I'm ready.
First item comes from Forbes. This is Airline Earnings Roundup, where Delta soared, United, Continental, and JetBlue sink. So, first quarter earnings numbers are out. Delta Airlines, they did pretty well. Operating revenue up 5% over last quarter to $8.9 billion. Net income rose to $281 million. The winter weather cost them some money. In fact, all of the airlines talk about that. I think for Delta, they mention a $90 million hit due to the bad weather. And in the second quarter, Delta expects operating margins of 14 to 16%. That's pretty healthy. The other guys didn't fare quite so well. United Continental Holdings revenue down 0.3%, so that's essentially flat to $8.7 billion. They had a net loss of $609 million, and they attribute weather-related cancellations to to $200 million of the loss. Pretty significant.
Horrible, horrible winter. My goodness.
Yeah, that really affected all the airlines in the U.S., certainly. And I mean, that makes it tough. Rob, you really can't plan for the weather, can you?
Well, no. And of course, this year was worse than anything we've had in, I can't even remember how many years. But I just want to touch on that because if Dan were still here, our little buddy Dan Webb, 16% margins
for an airline.
Yeah. I mean, you need to realize that in the airline world, most of the time the margins are in the low end of the single digits. So that's pretty astounding. Delta must be doing something the shareholders are going to like.
Even Southwest did pretty well. Of course, a lot smaller, $4.2 billion in revenue for the first quarter. But their net income was up 158%. That's a first quarter record.
And that's all anybody really cares about. I mean, you don't really care. You'd like to see revenues go up, but if you can keep the revenues even steady and costs steady, but that income, the moolah that you get to keep, that goes up. That's nice to see.
And, you know, one thing that's also sometimes you see in the press, especially when an airline or even if many of them as a group do extremely well and you see these hundreds of millions of dollars of profits and so forth. The thing to keep in mind is you really need to, in this industry, you really need to look at that over time because it's kind of a feast to famine. It's a very cyclic industry. And it's usually good to look at maybe over the last 10 years, what's the net been? Because sometimes it's actually not as rosy as, you know, the numbers would suggest.
Well, especially when Delta is saying they expect. Who knows? I mean, lots of things can happen. But let's see how it turns out. But
sure.
That's certainly some kind of pretty impressive belief that something really great's going to happen. But I did think it was kind of funny that the title didn't even... They went, oh, yeah, and Southwest made a couple bucks, too. I mean, no. So I was really surprised at that, but...
All right, let's move on to the next item. This comes from the AOPA blog, Coming Soon to a Television Station Near You is the title. And this is by Jamie Beckett, who is, I guess he's president of Polk Aviation Alliance. I think that they promote aviation in Florida. I don't know, Rob, do you know Jamie, Rob?
No, I've never met him, but our paths have crossed in the blogosphere.
Okay. Well, Jamie asks, is there room for a network devoted to aviation? And just to sort of give you the idea. He says, today we have a channel for everything, it seems. We've got channels about food, channels devoted to travel, science fiction channels, game show channels, military channels, cartoon channels, news channels, music channels, kids channels, movie channels, religious, did I say movie twice? Religious channels, shopping channels, gay channels, independent programming channels. And he says, even C-SPAN, perhaps the most important and the most snore-inducing channel to ever come down the pike. But what don't we have? We don't have a dedicated aviation channel. Now, Make, you've been in the television business. It's not easy to create a channel, let alone one dedicated to a specific topic.
Right. Well, I mean, look at Oprah Winfrey, you know, most powerful woman in the world, and she's had trouble with her own network. So, you know, do we need an aviation channel? Absolutely. My gosh, we got channels with animals running around. Why can't we have aviation? And I know it costs a lot of money, and I know there's a lot of work involved, but you know what? We are past due, aren't we?
Oh, come on. Come on. You're going to tell me that you think airplanes are going to beat little puppies and kitties? They're so cute.
I know. They're so cute, little doggies and puppies.
But don't we did have, didn't we have, what was it, David?
We love all the stories and all the characters that come with the airplanes.
That's true, especially.
I find it 100%.
I believe that. I agree with you. And David, you're the history guy. Didn't we have the Aviation Channel on about 10 years ago on cable? Wasn't it on the History Channel, too, well, or something? Or something?
Originally, there was an Aviation Channel. It became the Military Channel. Now it's the American History American Heroes Channel. But the bottom line is, folks, there's not enough market for an airplane channel. It's just not ever going to happen.
You don't think so?
Don't say that.
Hosts of the show are.
It depends on the shows. I think if we can have enough variety and attract women, more women in different walks of life and different ages, I think we can do it. But like the Military Channel, I remember that. Yes, it was boring. I'm sorry. And meaning no disrespect to our veterans, but a lot of the aviation stuff in the past has just been boring. So I think it depends upon a lot of different programming to aviation. We can do it.
So guys like to have TV shows where they blow stuff up.
No, I like TV shows that actually have like a message or whatever. The problem is no one is going to fork out the money. I don't see AOPA ramping up some funds to do an AOPA network. I mean, it's where's the money going to come from? And this goes back to this. My hate thing is, so what's the point? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, aviation. You can find a show about aviation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You just don't go to one particular channel.
But if all those were consolidated into one channel, wouldn't that be attractive? I mean, we've seen a number of different programs, aviation programs. Some of them have come and gone. Some of them are still, still around. There's a wide variety. I mean, some of them are documentaries. Some of them are, sort of the popular kinds of stuff that we see these days, reality show kinds of topics. But there ought to be enough content, it seems like, that you could...
I think so. I think there would be enough content. But David, you're right. Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for the network? And, Air and Space TV, Air and Space would be perfect. And Philip Hurst has worked on this for many years, and I worked with him at Sun and Fun a couple years ago, shooting a pilot for that. And I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. I'm ever the optimist, and we know there are people out there with money, that somebody is going to believe in this at some point. And did you read about the new show idea called Airfare America? This isn't a network, but this is a serious proposal. It's in its infancy. I don't know if it'll happen or not. Let's hope it does. But that's where they travel to different little airports, meet exciting people, eat the famous dish that the area is known for, the airport serves. I think that would be a lot of fun to meet different people, hear their stories, learn about their airplanes, learn about their town, go shopping, go to the beach, let's eat. I do think there's a market for that, and I think that would have a bigger appeal and attract women. I want to attract women to aviation, not just veterans who are reminiscing about their days in the Air Force or in the war. What do you think about that, Dave? The show Airfare America. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
We've had them on our show. Actually, we had them from, and in all fairness, there is someone who has proposed a show called The $100 Hamburger on this here podcast. My problem is, okay, you have a 24-hour network devoted to aviation. Who's going to watch it? And how are you going to cross over and do a Food Network kind of thing to grab a more general audience when it comes to that?
But look at networks like Animal Planet. They've got shows on there about things you couldn't even imagine. Or the Learning Channel. You know, it started a certain way, and now it's got topics on there from freaks to who knows what.
But my question is, how many of these networks, Maykay, have you seen the same show run over and over and over again?
You have a very good point there. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
And really, if we're going to compare it, probably the worst one to compare it to is the Animal Channel or Animal Planet, because there are so many. How many millions of cats, dogs, guinea pigs, snakes, frogs, birds, and whatever do we have in the U.S. alone? And there are, you know, not quite as many airplanes and pilots.
Anything is possible, guys.
Yeah, no, money. That's true. I listen. I don't doubt that someone's going to try. I just hope. Well, look at the Aviators TV is going into its fourth season, and they've managed to squeak by every year. But you know, they get the sponsors. So
yeah. You know, the sad thing is we don't have that in our market, so our cable doesn't carry it. I've never seen it. Hmm. I've interviewed the producers at AOPA's Summit, but I've never seen the show because we don't have it here. So isn't that sad?
Yeah, and that's been part of the problem with a number of these programs that have been produced, is that they're kind of tend to be in kind of limited markets. But that's maybe one of the things that an aviation channel could address. I don't know. Well, you know, why don't we ask our listeners, you know, what do you guys think? Does it make sense to you? Do you think it makes sense enough in a broad way that it's something that could be viable? Why don't you give us some feedback? Tell us what you think.
What do you think a bunch of airplane geeky people are going to say?
Well, we just heard from David. He's a geeky airplane person, and he's kind of pessimistic about the idea.
What's the matter with you, man?
I know.
He's kind of a practical guy.
He is.
Yeah. He's probably smarter than all of us.
Yeah. What was that you were drinking in those posts last night on Facebook, David? Flaming what?
A flaming volcano.
A flaming volcano. He'll spend his money at, maybe there should be a flaming volcano channel. Exotic drink channel.
That's called the Food Network.
Oh, okay. Oh, whatever. Okay.
All right. Hey, let's move on to a military item. We see from CNN, Dutch fighter jets intercept two Russian bombers in their airspace. And these were two Russian Tu-95 bombers. I guess these are called Bears, right? Those are the Bears, David?
Those are the Bears.
They entered Dutch airspace, and the Dutch scrambled some F-16s to escort them out. Is this really a big news item, David, or not?
Well, given certain other crises, it's Russia flexing its might. Actually, for 15 years, up until about 1998, and at the end of the Cold War, the Russians and the Soviets were not flying these bombers. And the Tu-95 is the Russian equivalent of a B-52. Now, I know that sounds kind of a stretch because it's a four-engined, turboprop-powered aircraft, but it and the B-52 have the same grandfather, which is the B-29. The B-29 became the Tu-4 Bull, and believe it or not, the B-52 original design, model 46435, was a swept wing turboprop with contra-rotating propellers.
Really?
So they're really very similar aircraft. But the Russians in the Cold War would fly them nonstop from north of Greenland. You know, there was a Greenland Iceland-UK gap, which they would fly down and then they would fly to Cuba. And this is their strategic long-range bomber. And about 10 years ago, Vladimir Putin said, guess what? We're going to start flying our aircraft again. and they go out over the North Sea, and inevitably either the Brits or the Dutch or somebody scrambles, the Danes scramble to catch these aircraft and make sure they don't incur their national airspace. In fact, about 2 years ago, we had some F-22s actually intercept them over towards Alaska. So in this time of sensitive things going on, it's kind of important that we be very sensitive. And it's Russia flexing its might another way for because of Ukraine. And that's why we're putting aircraft in Poland and et cetera to defend against this.
And then, of course, NATO wants to be able to demonstrate that, you know, they have an eye on the ball, too, right?
Yeah, it's a good lesson in QRA, which is quick reaction alert, which means Eurofighter Typhoons are on the ground and within 4 minutes are up in the air intercepting aircraft. So it's back to the Cold War days of intercepting bears over the North Atlantic and taking pictures of them taking pictures of us. So it's not really newsworthy, but it's a sign of the times.
All right. Well, good. Thanks, David. The last item we have before we move on to our main topic is from the KTAR affiliate. Park Service grants landmark status to 1956 midair collision site. So this is about the June 30th, 1956 collision between a, let's see, this is a, it's an L-1049 Super Constellation and a United DC-7 collided over the Grand Canyon, in which case all 128 people aboard the aircraft died. And we see here that the National Park Service has designated the site. It now is a National Historic Landmark. Well, you know, I think all accidents, or almost all accidents, aviation accidents, result in some positive change. Rob, this was kind of a big one, though, when it happened, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have to go back to 1956. That was the Eisenhower era. We were still just finishing up what was left of trying to get back to normal after the Korean conflict. And the air traffic control system in the United States was essentially non-existent. It was run by dispatchers who would hear pilot reports on the radio and then call up another crew and say, "Hey, we just heard so-and-so is over this place at this altitude, so keep an eye out for them." And I mean, it was crazy, but that's how it was. But of course, there wasn't not even close to as much air traffic as we have today. But the collision did wake everybody up, and about 18 months later, it wasn't called the Federal Aviation Administration then. It was called the Federal Aviation Authority, I think, or something. Wasn't that what FAA was before it was the administration?
Wasn't it CAA?
Well, maybe it was the CAA. See, I thought 58 was the FAA Act. And I may have to go back and look at that. But essentially, that's when they finally decided that air traffic control needed to be better organized. And it kind of took off from there. And over the last 55 years, we've been kind of watching it slowly improve. And I just think it's a little ironic that we're going to talk about FAA and air traffic control in the aviation minute tonight, because it's kind of funny when you look at where we started and where we've ended up. But because our air traffic control system, while it's great, we're short of air traffic controllers, too, even now.
Yeah, it was that the 1958 Federal Aviation Act that established the FAA.
Does it explain what FAA meant? I was almost positive it meant something other than administration the first time.
Oh, it could
but
be.
But maybe, you know, we should throw that open. One of our listeners knows.
Someone does, yes.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things I thought was interesting anyway is that the article mentions that, you know, some wreckage from that accident is still to be found in the canyon. They did, you know, clean it up after the accident, or at least at some point, but there's still remnants of the wreckage there. There is a kind of a sort of the hobbyist of, you know, aviation archaeology, I guess you could call it. Folks who go out and look for old crash sites and kind of because they're difficult to locate in many cases. And I think that they're generally pretty good about not removing wreckage bits and artifacts, things like that. Hopefully the same things here.
It's kind of a thing of respect that you find it and let's leave it be.
Right, exactly.
What's the point of taking it somewhere? You know, it's not a trophy. People died here. Let's bless it and leave it be.
Right.
Well, you know, it's funny that you, well, not funny. It's odd that we're talking about that because I was talking to somebody last week about the Cali crash. That was an American Airlines 757 that crashed into a mountain down in Colombia about, I don't know, what is that, 20 years ago maybe or something like that. And I knew somebody that was on the team in the jungle, and they said that when they got there, the plane was just, the wreckage was just covered with people trying to steal stuff, trying to get in there and take stuff from the airplane. And they had to basically chase them all off. So there are some, of course, that's also a pretty poor country, so who knows what they thought they might find there. But David, you know, something I was going to ask you, you're the historian. Why do you think it took 55 years for the National Park Service to agree to this? Any idea?
The National Park Service is a bureaucracy like everybody else in the government.
55 years?
Well, first of all, Rob, somebody has to come up with the bright idea to do it.
Okay.
And then then you need to start the process. So, I mean, a crash site does not necessarily, we have crash sites all over this country on a regular basis. But if a Cessna goes down somewhere in the Pine Barrens, for, let's say, does it really warrant being a national historic site? In this case, somebody had to come up with the, think it through, and then you have to sort of provide the justification to the U.S. Park Service on why it's a national historic site, and then you have to get Congress to buy in. So there's a lengthy process on how to make anything a historic site. So, and a lot of it probably had to do with it wasn't till, you know, till someone came up with the idea that yes, that needs to be a national historic site.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I don't work for the government anymore.
Again, we're speaking with May Kay Beeler. May Kay, this book, Buccaneer, The Provocative Odyssey of Jack Reed, Adventurer, Drug Smuggler, and Pilot Extraordinaire. This is, I mean, it's not really a story about flying. It's more about the story of a man who was a pilot.
Yeah, it's about a gentleman who was raised in a middle-class family in Riverside, California. He was born in 1930. He was expected to be kind of a goody-two-shoes. Back in those days, Pat Boone was the role model, and he just was a bit of a renegade from the get-go and didn't want to live that life and follow in those footsteps. He wanted to be an adventurer, and this book is his memoir. It's a biography. These are memoirs that he wrote in prison, and then I came into his life, and we wrote the biography together. I finished it for him, so to speak, and he was infamous because of his association with the Medellin cartel and a famous drug lord named Carlos Leiter, who was an associate of Pablo Escobar. Most everyone has heard of Pablo Escobar, unfortunately, a very, very violent man. But this is an adventure story. Jack Reed was not violent. He was just a maverick entrepreneur who used his maverick or rogue abilities as a pilot, smuggling cocaine for the cartel. And it was our joint interest in flying that brought us together, actually.
And kind of the, I mean, the activities of this guy's life spans a, you know, wide spectrum of things, including at one point he held the land speed record for electric powered cars. But with respect to his, you know, his flying, and I think he originally started out kind of running pot from Mexico. Isn't that sort of where,
yes,
where he started that?
And actually, he learned to fly. I think it was a brother-in-law's charter business out west. And he flew gamblers to Vegas, you know, trying to do some honest work. But then he discovered the joys that he enjoyed of marijuana, and then began smuggling pot out of Mexico using his pilot skills to do that, and then that eventually led to the cocaine. For Jack Reed, flying was strictly a business. So when I came into his life, actually I was doing research on a documentary called Return to Norman's Key, where there's a crash landing on that island that's why I know about you should respect the remains of airplanes. There's just a certain energy to that, and you go and you kind of pick up neat things, then they think, you know what, this just needs to be left alone. But anyway, that's a different story about Norman's Key. It was the epicenter of the world's largest drug operation at the time, and that's where Jack flew drugs from Colombia to Norman's Key, then to the States. A very fascinating story. I wanted to get research from him for that documentary, and he refused me. But then we just started talking about flying, and it was our joint love of flying that was an incredible connection. And he opened up to me and trusted me, and eventually gave me this incredible story about his life as a cartel pilot.
Now, I guess he flew a Piper Navajo twin, right, from Norman's Key to Columbia and back.
Yes, 50 Romeo Kilo. And I know you read the book, Max, and I know Rob and Dave, you hopefully will read the book, so we don't want to give too much away. But Max, isn't it fascinating how he describes those drug runs?
Oh, just amazing. I mean, I think at one point he says that, you know, if you really want to do this, you have to be a bush pilot because someone with those kinds of skills because of the kinds of places where you have to land and the kinds of environments you have to deal with.
Yes, very, very dangerous. You know, not smooth paved runways that we're used to. And back then, the GPS was not available to civilians. So he would fly over the ocean, you know, sometimes with no navigation aids at all, till they could finally pick up a VOR and then find landmarks and head on into Colombia, where they would land in the middle of nowhere. I don't know how he found those strips, these dirt runways or a field or whatever. And I don't know. It's really quite a fascinating read. And I want to make it clear, I'm not condoning what he did. I mean, that's, you know, unlawful, and we certainly don't want to encourage anything like that. But it's the story of his life, and we celebrate his life as an adventurer and as a very fascinating pilot.
How many years did he do this, Mekay?
He did it for 11. Well, let me think. He was on Norman's Key for 3 years, and he was involved with the other for probably 3 years. So 6 years total. And then after being on Norman's Key, he went to Colombia with the drug lord, and then he retired. He went off to Panama to live a life of a Robinson Crusoe type lifestyle, and that is so fascinating. Oh my gosh, who does that? He lived on what, $500 a year, just living off the land. He had retired from the drug smuggling business when all hell broke loose, and that's where you guys have to read the book.
So you mean he made all that money and he was living on $500 a year?
Because he was happy living off the land in Panama, living a simple life. He and his young girlfriend, it's also a love story, and it's quite fiery and sexy as well. He had a young girlfriend, and they lived quite an adventurous life together. He didn't want to be around people. He was a bit of a loner. Loved animals, loved nature. Just wanted to live off the land. That's where he was happiest. And I know, I hear you. You know, a lot of people say, my God, he made all that money and he just went and lived in the jungle. That's where he was happiest.
Oh, darn.
And Rob, you remember back in the 60s and 70s when this sort of thing was going on? Remember, you know, you would hear the phrase the establishment all the time. People were against the establishment.
Sure. You know, don't trust anybody over 30.
Right, and all that. And I think Jack was kind of, you know, from that era, in this, from the standpoint that you know, he didn't trust the establishment. He didn't really want to live in the establishment. You know, that's, you know, part of the freedom of flying, but it's also part of the you know, the lifestyle and the approach to life that he took. You know, interesting, he didn't, even though he was, you know, ferrying this cocaine. Well, let me just mention this. One of the things I learned about the drug smuggling business from this book is that there are really three functions that are kind of independent. There's the manufacture of the drug, there's the transportation of the drug, and there's the distribution of the drug. And Jack Reed was only involved in the transportation part of it, right? He just saw his role kind of limited to that.
Yes.
And he didn't also have a problem with that. No, he likened cocaine to alcohol or, you know, cigarettes, that people are allowed to sell those. And he didn't really make a distinction, I think, in his mind. You sort of get that impression, May Kay?
Oh, no, it's completely right. That's totally right. That's the way he saw it. He didn't see it as a drug that's going to hurt people and ruin lives. That's not who he was. He was a very gentle soul. And when he discovered marijuana, and he talks about that, marijuana gave him great happiness. I mean, in today's world, he would be a great candidate for medicinal marijuana, because it really did enhance his life. It didn't control it. He wasn't numbed out, but it enhanced his life. And he went from marijuana to cocaine as far as transportation is concerned. And he never did it to hurt anybody. And he didn't have remorse about it. He didn't say he was sorry for it. He didn't regret doing that. On the other hand, his co-defendant, this drug lord, Carlos Slater, has been quoted as saying that it was the Latin American time bomb, cocaine, that it would ruin America. So there are people that have different mindsets about this. And when you think about the violence associated with cartels, of course, oh my God, Mexican cartels are horrible. And the Medellin cartel, the Colombian mafia, was so violent as well. That violence is pretty much regarding the distribution process, not the transportation process. And Jack was involved in the transportation process. So as a pilot, I was in awe. I was so compelled reading these stories. I was enthralled about how the trips went and where he landed and how he didn't get lost and what was involved in that. But no, he had no remorse about transporting the drugs. He thought he was fulfilling a service. He was very popular for it. He was very well paid for it. It enabled him to live the lifestyle that he wanted. He could go live in Panama and not worry about having to make money to live in the establishment. Yes, he had money. He didn't have to spend it, though. He lived off the land, and he took great pride in that.
So it's an interesting story. I think it's interesting on, you know, different levels. There's the piloting level, of course, but there's also other social issues. It was amazing to me that, you know, when you think of drug cartel people, you know, I automatically don't want to like these people. But
Me neither.
And many of them turn out to be kind of likable.
Well, this is something that I learned as a journalist. Of course, I've been a journalist forever. And being a journalist, you have to have an open mind. You know, we are not to judge, and sometimes we want to judge. But the more stories I do, the more people I meet around the world from all walks of life, I learn to open my mind. And we can't possibly judge unless we walk in someone's shoes. And when I first started corresponding with Jack Reed in prison, he had been in there over 20 years. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's got to be this horrible outlaw. And no, he had evolved into a very spiritual man. He was very intellectual, very kind man, better manners than most people you would meet in this day and age. And I learned, my gosh, don't you dare judge somebody just because they've been in jail or just because they broke the law. It's an amazing story of his evolution and being the Pat Boone type youngster and then evolving into an outlaw. And what we haven't talked about that readers will love about this book is, before the acronym BFF was ever around, Jack Reed was the best friend forever of his comrade, who was this drug lord. And what he did to protect his friend, this fierce loyalty, is part of the story. And how he spends almost the rest of his life, Jack Reed, behind bars because he didn't rat or snitch on his best friend. So the story is also about the judicial system. It's about a lot of media hype. This was the longest running drug trial in U.S. history. This involved the first Colombian drug lord to be extradited to the United States. Jack happened to be his co-defendant because they were best friends. So you're right, Max. There are a lot of different elements to the story. And it's kind of a multi-love story as well. And there's kind of a miracle at the end. So, oh my goodness, it's just it's jam-packed with all sorts of goodies. So if you love adventure, you're going to love the book. If you love flying, you're going to love the book. You know, people say to me, well, were you interested in crime? Were you interested in drug cartels? Heck no. Are you kidding? Absolutely not. No. It was just this man's fascinating life that oh my God, I thought your story must be told. It must be told.
And I found it on Amazon.com. Is that the best place?
Yes.
Or where can you
our publisher, Strategic Media Books, of course, what we would prefer you to buy the book is straight through the publisher, and that is Strategic media, books. Yes, it is available on Amazon. You can go down to Barnes & Noble, to your local bookstore, and buy it. It's available all over the world. You can just Google. You can go to maykbeeler.com. You can go to my website, and that'll lead you to the book. You can also Google me. You could Google Jack Carlton Reed, and you'll find Jack. There are all sorts of places you can get the book.
All right, great. And we'll put those links in the show notes so folks can get that to that easily. Make, we want to talk about the Diva Flight Program. Now, this is, how long have you been involved in this?
Well, I've been involved in it for a couple of years. I was really trying to launch it. It's here local in Greensboro, North Carolina, but I was really wanting to move to an island and Diva Flight Program down there. And it took me several years to finally get one of the world's largest resort chains to let me be an activity vendor and bring Diva Flight. We'll tell folks what Diva Flight is in a minute. But then it turned out that after I finally got the approval, the insurance was prohibitive. Yeah, I had to have like $100 million in insurance or something. It was like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
So here I'm in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the Diva Flight experience is to empower women through aviation. Now, we know only 6% of the pilot population is female. We need more gals. I mean, oh my gosh, it's the most fun you'll ever have. As a female, I am so privileged and just impassioned by this every day of my life that I get to fly. And I want to share it with so many other women. But let's face it, a lot of women are never going to learn to fly. So the Diva Flight Experience just invites them to come out and fly with me, be it a one-hour Diva Flight, or maybe a couple hours. We're actually going to go somewhere fun, to the beach. They are in the pilot seat. They are at the controls. But with me being a flight instructor, I can guide them and let them fly as little or as much as they want. And what happens with this is, because they're not committed to getting a private pilot certificate, because they've got all these other obligations at home with family or whatever, this is, they can just relax. They can just go out and fly for an hour or fly for a couple hours with me, or even through first solo if they want. And just have the time of their lives.
And so how many women have, taken advantage of this?
Well, my goodness. I have flown so many women over the years, and it's been such a joy. And I think I've been doing Diva Flight all this time. I'm just now calling it the Diva Flight Experience. I guess for about a year. I have women actually signed up and come to me specifically for the Diva Flight Experience yet. Very few. What happens is they'll come to our flight school, and it'll be their birthday. Or just the other day, it was this gal's 30th birthday. And she was just perfect for the Diva Flight Experience. So this is just something I kind of do. I kind of take them under my wing, and I, just ensure that they have a wonderful flight and explain everything to them in a way that they can understand it and have fun. And a lot of women think this is a male thing. And we know it's a boys' club, right? Guys, we know it's a boys' club. But a lot of women think, oh, I'm not smart enough. Can you believe in this day and age, there are women who are not smart enough to do this? And I say, oh, no. It has nothing to do with how smart you are. It's, do you want to do it? If you want to learn something, you can learn anything. It's a matter of the passion to put in the time and the effort to do it. And I try to make this as simple as possible for them so that it's empowering. So when they leave after the end of the flight or several flights, go, I did this. I flew an airplane. And you know what? It wasn't hard. And you know what? It was really freeing, and it was really empowering, and I will never forget it. And that is, that's the greatest prize I could ever have, is to see the smiles on their faces and the emails that I get afterwards and say, thank you so much. I'll never forget you.
Do you have many people that come back and say, I thought about it. I'd actually like to go through the whole process to learn to fly.
Yes. Not a lot, though. Rob, I'm going to be honest with you. Not a lot. But there have been a few, and I'm working with a few right now. And we've had a horrible winter. My gosh, we've had to cancel one gal. We've had to cancel 10 of her flights for the course of the winter. Either it was snowing or the wind has just been howling. And we've gone up in turbulent conditions. And, when you're a new pilot or just learning to fly, I don't want to take people up in bumpy conditions. It's not fun. It scares them. And I say, you're safe or okay, but it's not fun. So, hoping for better weather. You don't want to do it when it's blowing to 40 out.
And if anyone's having trouble visualizing just what the power of this is, we have a photo. This is this shows Mae Kay and the woman who's celebrating her 30th birthday. in, let's see, you guys are in a, what, a Cessna 172?
It's a Cessna 172, so the husband's in the back with those big eyes.
We'll put this in the show notes over at airplanegeeks.com. So, yeah, you've got to check this out. It's you look at the smiles on these faces, and you get the picture right away.
And it's really funny because she had just found out she was pregnant, and she was loving every minute of it. And her husband in the back, we were just so happy. I mean, it was just a happy, happy day and a happy celebration. And normally, I don't want to do a commercial for Liberty Aerospace, but I am the Liberty aircraft girl. My favorite airplane is a 21st century state-of-the-art aircraft. And it's got a stick, and it's got two seats, low wing, composite aircraft, just, so much fun. And normally, I do my diva flights in that aircraft, but it's only two seats. But this time, the husband wanted to come along, so of course, you know, we went to a bigger airplane. So we were in the classic Cessna 172. And the neat thing about Diva Flight is, and that we all know, doesn't matter what you fly, we love all airplanes, don't we?
Of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, Diva Flight is for guys, too. I mean, if guys would like to come with me, it's all wonderful. And that's my specialty. It's my specialty. It's kind of the discovery flight taken to a different level.
Very good.
Yeah, but you know what I want to know about is that you didn't ever leave anybody up there and say, by the way, did I ever tell you I'm a skydiver? Here, watch this.
I know you're trying to.
Nobody jumps out of a perfectly good airplane.
Exactly. And the only time I skydived, it was with the Navy SEALs, and that was for a TV show many, many years ago. Turned out I was pregnant at the time, too, so my son was along for that.
Well, speaking of your son, now is this, do you have just the one son?
I have the one son.
Okay, so this is the one son then that you have passed along your aviation genes to, haven't you?
Well, bless his heart, I don't think he had any choice because when I was pregnant with him, I was training to become a CFI. So I was going through all my flight instructor training with him on board in utero. And then in addition to that, I was training for World Aviation Records in the Quest Air Venture aircraft. So I don't know if anybody remembers, that was called the Flying Egg. And it was designed by Jim Griswold.
Oh, I remember that.
Hmm. Yeah, and Jim had designed the Learjet and the Malibu, the Piper Malibu. So RJ, my son, he really had no choice. He was pregnant with me as I trained for the world records and became a CFI. And his dad was the original test pilot for HondaJet. So how cool is that?
Oh, wow.
Kid has no choice. And then, of course, we flew all the time. He's grown up flying with me, and he loves it. He soloed on his 16th birthday, got his license on his 17th birthday. It's such a joy. Now, if he didn't like flying, that would be okay. I just want the kid to be happy.
Sure.
That's all. Right? But he just happens to love flying. So that's, yay, bonus.
That's pretty cool.
It is, yeah. All right, well, Maykay, thank you so much. Tell us again where folks can find you online and learn more about the things that you do.
Okay. Well, maykaybeeler.com, and Maykay is like Mayday with a C, MAYCAYBEELER.com, maykaybeeler.com. Information there about a Return to Norman's Key. We didn't talk about that documentary on the crash landing on the island in the Bahamas that kind of led me to the book about Jack Reed. That's on there. Information about the book, Buccaneer, The Provocative Odyssey of Jack Reed, Adventure, Drug Smuggler, and Pilot Extraordinaire. Brand new release. Love for you all to go out and read it. It might be sensitive to some, I'm going to be honest with you, because this is a legal activity. There is a little bit of feisty love affair in it, a fiery love affair, I should say. So I really don't recommend it for young people. One of my 16-year-old flight students just bought it, and I thought, oh, my God. And his mother said, it's okay, he's 16, he can handle it. So you can get that also on Strategic Media Books, and or you can go to Amazon.com, you can go to your local bookstore. So it's out there, and I hope you'll all enjoy it.
I was going to say, I really hope that we have you back again one of these days. And if we buy the book from Strategic Media Books, how would we get you to sign it?
I know. Well, I think that my publisher is going to have me sign a few in advance, but I think you guys should come to Greensboro, North Carolina, and do a Diva Flight with me.
Ooh, now there's an idea.
And by the way, I didn't mention Diva Flight, DivaFlight.com. You can find me through DivaFlight.com also. Also, Fly TAA.com. I don't want to give all these plugs. I know you guys got other things to talk about. Why don't you guys come fly with me in Greensboro, take the show on the road?
Ooh, I like that idea.
Yeah, learn what's new in flight training. Oh, and guess what, guys? We're going to have an aero camp this summer for kids 12 to 16, and Andrew is going to help us with that. He's going to come over and tell the kids about the Honda Jet. So
when's that going to be?
Let me think. I think it's June 23rd for a week, and then July 14th for a week. We're just now starting to advertise. It's called Aero Camp. And the kids are going to go to the Tower. They're going to go to Timco. FedEx is here at our airport now. We're going to talk to the wildlife folks because we've got this huge international airport here with lots of wildlife. You know, all sorts of fun activities. The fire station for the kids. So they're going to learn a lot. And, oh, my gosh, I'm the director. Wish me luck.
Boy, if anybody could handle adventure, it sounds like it's you.
Okay. Well, wish me luck. Thank you.
You're a busy woman.
Hey, thanks for coming on.
And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in this week's NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hey guys, this week on NBAA's Flight Plan, we're talking about the Regional Leadership Roundtable. It's a place where leaders of aviation groups around the country can compare notes, and for those who want to start a local or regional group, to get some great tips from those who've been running them for years. Check it all out this week at NBAA.org.
All right, thanks Pete. And now it's time for the Airplane of the Week with David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the weird, the wacky, and the wonderful P3 variants. In the beginning, it was clear that the P3 could be more than just a sub-hunter. Project ST/SPIN was created using three P3As. The P3As were to replace RB-69s of the CIA for overflights of mainland China. Raytheon converted the P3As. Additional air scoops were added to the fuselage forward to the wing for air sampling. For those who don't know, air sampling in military parlance is the term for searching for radioactive materials that are dispersed after a nuclear test blast, as well as side-looking airborne radar for observation of the Chinese coast. The propellers were clipped and the engines were shrouded to lower engine heat signatures. The bomb bay was given a leaflet dispenser. The P-3 was also given a cargo door to allow to supply clandestine operatives. The mad gear was taken out and the chafe dispensers were put in its place. But now this is where it gets weird. The ST-SPIN aircraft were painted overall gloss black, and the P-3A was given the ability to fire the AIM-9B Sidewinder from the wings. Backwards. One ST-SPIN aircraft was designated EP-3A and was flown as an electronic test platform. Two others, Buno numbers 149678 and 149669, were modified to become EP-3B's BATRAC standard. The BATRAC replaced the bomb bay with the OE-319 retractable radar, known as the M&M. A large antenna suite on both the top and bottom of the fuselage were protected by aerodynamic fairings. VQ-1 would fly the pair out of Da Nang during the Vietnam War, and they flew on into the late 1980s. BATRAC led the U.S. Navy to develop Ares. 10 P-3As were converted to EP-3E Ares 1 standards. The Airborne Reconnaissance Integrated Electronics System. These aircraft would replace Lockheed EC-121M Constellations. The EP-3 had the Big Look AN-ALQ-1110 radar and advanced communication suite. The Ares system was the Navy's primary threat warning aircraft during Operation Desert Storm. In the mid-1990s, the Navy took 12 low-time P-3Cs and siloped them, silop being conversion in lieu of procurement. The Ares 2 system built on the Ares 1 and added SATCOM and GPS. The Ares 2 aircraft is cramped, and the normal crew for the aircraft is 24. It was an Aries 2 that on April 1st, 2001 was patrolling the South China Sea. The aircraft was intercepted by the Chinese J-8 Finback aircraft. After two close passes, on the third one, the J-8 struck the Aries and broke into two pieces. The pilot of the Finback was killed. For 26 minutes, the crew destroyed all sensitive data. If you want to know how to do that in a P3 Aries, what you do is you pour hot coffee on all of the electronic drives as well as the floppy disks. Eventually, the aircraft landed on Hainan Island. The crew was detained for 10 days. Eventually, the P3 was dismantled as a courtesy and flown back via an AN-124 to the United States. Burr number 156511 was rebuilt and is still flying today. The most colorful P3s ever flown were from VXN-8. The mission of VXN-8 was oceanographic development. Based out of Patuxent River, Maryland, the missions were flown with each P3 being adorned with a licensed Warner Brothers cartoon character. Project Bird's Eye mascot was the Arctic Fox, which tracked polar ice flows. Project Magnet, which mapped the Earth's magnetic field, featured the Roadrunner, and lastly, Project Seascan featured Wile E. Coyote. Although these were Navy-run projects for oceanographic research, ice flows, magnetospheres, and Seascan, which was to map the ocean floor, are clearly designed to help nuclear submarines and fleet ballistic submarines. If VXN-8 had the prettiest P3s, VX-30 at Point Magoo has the ugliest. The NP3D EATS has a billboard dorsal film. The large square EATS antenna, the extended area test system, takes up a large portion of the tail and looks like a flying billboard. The five NP3Ds that have been converted are used to gathering test data on missiles. Anything from AIM-9 Sidewinder tests up to the LGM-118 Peacekeeper nuclear ballistic missile. One of the EATS birds is equipped with Cast Glance. Cast Glance is a high-resolution image-stabilized camera. It is the 80s and 90s version of a DJI Phantom. And actually, Cast Glance was used twice to film Discovery's return to flight missions. NOAA, or the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, flies two WP3Ds. Their names are Kermit and Miss Piggy. The WP3Ds are unique that they have a C-band radar and a retractable dome housed in the bomb bay. This radar can provide 360-degree weather coverage. The tail stinger is much fatter and has a faceted radar that holds the X-band Doppler radar. The fuselage has additional observation windows. Each aircraft also has a large candy-striped data air probe. The ASDL, or Aircraft Satellite Data Lake, allows for real-time data to be provided to ground stations as the aircraft tend to fly into hurricanes. And lastly, we come to slicks and domes. In 1983, Lockheed modified former RAF A9-299 into an AEW&C aircraft. The P3 Airborne Early Warning and Control aircraft took the rotodome of an E-2C and placed it on the fuselage just in front of the tail. Believe it or not, the lift generated by the APA-171 radar counteracts its weight. Eventually, all three of these AEW&C aircrafts were delivered to the United States Customs Service for the war on drugs. After 9/11, four more were purchased by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and are now part of the Department of Homeland Security. The Sentinel, as it became part of a hunter-tiller team. The P3 or LRT, or long-range tractor, are Borders and Customs Patrol aircraft without the rotodome to intercept surface ships and aircraft. LRTs have a sensor turret in the nose for infrared and long-range TV. So there you have it. The P3. Yes, there are versions they missed or countries to fly it. But so next week, we're going to have another Jamie Dotson production, and I will take a break. So this has been your mad historian, David M. Vanderhoof, signing off.
Wow. Thank you, David. You deserve a break after that massive four-part series.
Yeah, it was fun, but I'm glad it's done.
All right. Good. And we'll look forward to another Airplane of the Week report from Jamie Dotson. He did a great job last time.
Yep. And I've got to keep encouraging him because so he keeps writing them. So maybe I'll eventually get my fourth book.
All right.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 28th of April, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 297. Grant, back here in the studio this week after all that fun you and I flying around all over the countryside up there in New South Wales.
Oh, it was great, mate. I really enjoyed my time going flying in the balloons and, taking a few people who'd never flown in balloons before up for their first go.
Oh, yes, and another trip for me in the Cirrus too. And why can't I have one of them? Why does Rob Mark get to fly them all the time and I don't? That's what I want to know.
Mate. You got a bad case of Cirrus envy happening here?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful aircraft. Actually, at this stage in my flying career, I'd even fly a Tomahawk. No, I wouldn't, actually. Yes, that's not true.
If you could fit into one, you'd fly it.
Well, I'd get into one. It's just getting out. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Let's get onto the news this week, Grant. Actually, this is news from last week. You know, I said last week when we were flying around that it had been a pretty slow news week, but I may have just forgotten the major story, which is, apparently that's Sydney Airport, Sydney's second airport, that we've been saying for years will never happen, and I'm still rather cynical. Well, Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced a couple of weeks ago that it actually is going to go ahead, and yeah, there you go. Yeah, do you believe it, Grant? I'm not sure if I do.
I think that's why we skipped it as not being big news, because, hey, you know, come on, we've heard it all before.
I know we've heard it all before. Well, let's hear from the Prime Minister himself, shall we? I know how much you like him.
Oh, go for it.
Today, the Cabinet has confirmed that Badgerys Creek will be Sydney's second airport. It will be an airport for Western Sydney. The planning and design work will start immediately, and my expectation is that construction will begin in 2016. This is a long overdue decision. In fact, people started talking about the need for Sydney to have a second airport when the Deputy Prime Minister and I were still at school. So it's a long overdue decision, which, to be honest, has been shirked and squibbed by successive governments for far too long. The vast bulk of the spending required to produce an airport will be by the private sector. I also want to stress that the government's approach will be roads first, airport second, because we don't want the people of Western Sydney to have to have an airport without having the decent transport infrastructure that Western Sydney deserves. And that audio thanks to Fairfax Media on the Sydney Morning Herald website. Now, Grant, I was just looking at my calendar here. You know, three-year political terms, they were elected in 2013. Well, 2016's an election year.
Oh, so do you think the sod will actually turn?
Well, that's no way to talk about our Prime Minister, Grant.
Oh, wow. That wasn't me, folks. That was Vischer.
there you go. Okay. Yeah, well, I don't know. Like, you know, how many times have we talked about this, Grant? These sorts of announcements have been made before. This one seems a little bit more definitive, shall we say. I think we both agree that they do need another airport there. I've long thought that Sydney has the airport infrastructure that they deserve because, you know, as we said before, everybody there seems to agree that they want an airport. It's just that they don't want another airport, so go figure.
They don't want it in their backyard, and of course the NIMBYs are up in arms about Badgerys Creek being selected for the second airport. But, you know, mate, it was the Keating government that actually made the famous comment of how they were going to stop work on Badgerys Creek, because that was back in development way back then, mate, way back then. They were working on Badgerys Creek as the second airport. They owned the land. Everything was starting to happen. And then a minister made the famous comment of how they were stopping work on the project in order to fast track it, which had most of us going, say what now?
Yeah,
and of course, nothing happened for a while. A change of government, the Howard government gets in, and they turn around and go, well, clearly nothing's happening on here. So we're going to take this money earmarked for that project and use it for something else. So, and since then, it's just been in limbo, and they've had report and survey and assessment and study and all other kinds of stalling devices that have, of course, all indicated that Badgerys Creek is the choice location for a second Sydney airport. But they've tried looking at all sorts of other places, even Picton down to the south, which has mine subsidence, valleys that need to be filled in, and all sorts of stuff like that. And it keeps coming back to Badgerys Creek. Even the survey that was told to find somewhere other than Badgerys Creek came back and said Badgerys Creek. So finally, with the new government coming in last year, we knew this was going to happen. They have actually done it. It's going to go ahead. until somebody changes their mind.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the big factors here, of course, is that the current owners of the Sydney Airport, the Sydney Airports Corporation, well, they have first right of refusal over whether or not they'd like to operate that. And they have 12 months before they need to come back to the government with an answer on that. So the owner of that corporation, Max Moore-Wilton, has been quite vocal with his thoughts on the subject over the years. Of course, naturally, he wants to maximise the return to the current Sydney Airport. Of course, he is quite of the opinion that the current Sydney Airport, if it was unshackled a little bit from the ridiculous curfews and stuff that it has around it, well, yeah, probably they could accommodate more aircraft. I believe that's the case, but I still believe that they need another airport in that city.
Yeah, definitely, mate, definitely. And, you know, of course, Max Moore-Wilton is saying they don't need another one. He's pump-priming Sydney Airport's apparent value because Macquarie Group that owns it have been selling down their ownership over time. Of course, they don't want everyone to go, oh, hey, and see the price drop. They want to get top dollar for their investment as they sell out. So I suspect once Macquarie thinks they've sold down to the right level, then they might change their tune a little. But, you know, hopefully the whole thing does not become a giant non-event.
Yeah, you're right, Grant, a non-event. And in fact, speaking of things that were in this week's aviation news that turned out to be, well, quite a non-event, let's talk about a hijack, Grant. Let's talk about a hijack of a Virgin Australia aircraft. Or if you're the mainstream media, Virgin Blue or Virgin Atlantic or, well, anything else, yeah, but Virgin Australia. Well, actually, I don't think it was a hijack at all, was it, mate?
No, it wasn't, and I'm surprised that the mainstream media didn't have a red tail in the photos, unlike referring to them as Virgin Blue, that they haven't been for how long now? But yes, a Virgin Australia 737 on the way to Bali, quite similar to the one that I've actually been on. They had a bit of an incident where a gentleman was banging on the door to the cockpit. This triggered a bit of a scare for the pilots up front, who triggered the, hey, we're being possibly hijacked alarms. And the aircraft, when it landed in Bali, was stormed by the Indonesian military.
Yes, and they looked rather enthusiastic about it as well. Now, of course, you know, the headlines basically came through, you know, from a lot of the media outlets here initially saying that the aircraft had been an attempted hijacking and the aircraft was landing in Bali. Now, that's very interesting, Grant, because the actual destination of that aircraft was, well, Bali.
Bali, that's right. And I find it quite interesting that the guy was banging on the cockpit, because if this aircraft was one of the ones that has a business class in it, he would have had to have gone through the little rope thing that they put across the aisle, because when I was in business class, the plebs down the back couldn't get up to the front toilets. But, oh yeah, toilets. That's what apparently happened. The guy thought the cockpit door was a toilet and was trying to get in. And, yeah, thanks to all that, the transponder code of 7500 was set about half an hour out from landing, and Indonesian authorities actually closed the airport for almost an hour, causing 13 flights to be diverted or delayed.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is actually, Grant, I also read somewhere that not only did the aircraft complete its flight in Bali, it actually made it ahead of schedule. So I don't know what that says, but the passenger was a gentleman by the name of Matt Lockley, a 28-year-old, and a lot of people were alleging he was drunk. He's denied this in the media today, and in fact, he told police that he'd taken only Panadol, Voltaren, and consumed Coca-Cola before the flight. So I don't know what that means. I'm not even sure if I believe that, but anyway, it doesn't really matter. He's appearing as though he's going to be let off after helping the local police with their inquiries, and I don't know whether he'll be continuing his holiday, but I believe he will be flying back with Virgin, so it looks like all is forgiven.
Yeah, he's actually being deported. They're sending him back, coming back this week. Basically, he was going over there to find his Indonesian wife, whom he hasn't heard from for some time, and was going over to find out what was what, and was, yes, already a little distraught, and then apparently woke up confused and was needing to go to the toilet and thought the door to the cockpit was the toilet.
Oh, well, anyway, all's well that ends well, and I'm sure that he won't be taking that cocktail of over-the-counter drugs and Coca-Cola again anytime soon.
Yeah, mate, you got to watch out for that Coca-Cola. It's pretty vicious stuff.
I don't know, not even Coca-Cola. I talk about Voltaren, I thought that was stuff. I rubbed that on my sore knee. Why would you want to eat it?
I don't think I want to go there.
Maybe he was clutching his throat. It was probably burning his throat, poor guy.
And he went to the toilet for water. Anyhow.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. There is another news item that we wanted to talk about this week, and that was was, of course, Australia's new purchase of the F-35, some more airframes brought there. But, Grant, we've run out of time. We'll save that one for next week.
You don't think we can twist their arm and get it through? David would love us to talk more on the F-35.
David would, but Max will kill me. So until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks. Forgive me, Max. Forgive me.
That's cool. He'll be fine.
He'll be fine.
I hope.
So I guess the lesson there is, if you're going to rap on a door on an airplane, make sure it's the toilet, not the cockpit door.
Especially if they open it.
That's right. You get a lot of trouble that way.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for Rob's Aviation Minute.
Oh boy, this week we have everything here. We have irony. We have bureaucracy. We have incompetence. We have anxiety all over the place. And it's about essentially the CTI program, which is the control tower program at a number of junior colleges, 36 of them around the United States. And the fact that FAA used to bring these people in after they trained at a junior college and ended up with a degree into the FAA to be controllers. And the FAA decided to change all that. Oh, you got to hear how they did it and what happened. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. The FAA is running short of air traffic controllers here in the U.S., a problem the agency's known about for more than a decade. In fact, late last year, the agency conducted a few emergency hires of ex-military controllers to help fill in some of the gaps. Enter an FAA partnership program with 36 community colleges called the College Training Institute, or CTI. The relationship between these two organizations, according to the FAA, is a relationship they value in the training and hiring of new air traffic controllers. Using ATC classroom and simulator training, the schools award graduates a degree and all the academic experience to help make them solid air traffic controllers. The FAA puts so much faith in the CTI training, as well as the money the colleges have spent on the program, that until recently they were willing to shave 5 weeks off a new controller's total training time at the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City, just for CTI grads. That exemption's worth about, $11,000 per student by some estimates. As late as last summer, FAA people were telling applicants at AirVenture that a CTI school was the way to go to become a controller. Then, last winter, all 36 schools received an FAA email saying the agency had decided to change the way it hired new controllers. The agency said they were after better qualified candidates, a more diverse crowd, and of course, the FAA wanted to save money. Right now, the FAA fails about half of the candidates in every controller training class, by the way. Because the 36 CTI colleges had spent considerable sums of money staffing and equipping training labs to teach ATC, the email was quite a shock. Talking to the Association of College Training Institutes, ACTI, a group that sprung up after the FAA pulled out the rug last winter, I learned that a sizable number of CTI graduates were hired by the FAA and performed well through training, better than those with zero experience. So, facing a shortage of controllers, the FAA decides to revamp hiring by now demanding every applicant fill out a biographical application first, before any potential employee testing takes place. Surprisingly, there was already a waiting list of 3,000 people who had already successfully passed the FAA entrance exam, something that cost each of them $800. That list of qualified people, well, that was just put in the trash can. And now everyone was told to start all over again. The CTI also wouldn't be used when considering a candidate. The FAA opened a new bid for controllers anyway late last year, and 30,000 people applied. But only 2,800 passed the biographical screening portion, the portion where they asked important questions like, how do you feel about changing the organization you work for? And asked next to nothing about the applicant's qualifications. These days, everyone can read between the lines when the word diversity is mentioned. It means the organization needs a better mix of Hispanics, women, and Black Americans. As long as they can do the job, works for me. Strangely, though, after turning the new controller hiring program upside down, the FAA didn't hire, well, for instance, a Black woman with a master's degree who scored 100% on the entrance exam. They also passed on three well-qualified Black men. and the number of well-qualified native Alaskan CTI grads they hired? Sorry, zero. So who did the agency hire primarily in this new diverse cost-saving hiring scheme? Actually, a bunch of white guys. Some with absolutely no aviation experience of any kind. Certainly not of the caliber of a CTI grad. Those they hired, of course, will not be able to bypass that first 5 weeks of training either. So multiply that $11,000 savings by the number of CTI grads the feds won't hire. The Association of CTI folks have called upon a number of congressional members for help, but writing letters to Mr. Huerta at FAA or Anthony Fox at DOT seem to have fallen on deaf ears. With the entire sleep apnea mandate from FAA still on my mind, I'd like to again thank the FAA for beginning to effectively tear down a great program, one that encouraged people to become air traffic controllers while also gaining a college degree that might make those students great potential FAA managers down the road. In case you missed it, this is a classic definition of shooting yourself in the foot. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark in Chicago. Was that not incredible?
All right, Rob, thanks for that. Yeah, something else, huh? But now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm welcomed back by Frances Peters from the Aviation Platform. Frances, welcome back across the pond.
Yeah, thank you very much, Peter. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back. Always interesting to hear from the motherland. And today it is all about KLM. The first time in 3 years they've got back into profit, but there is a big change on the way, and their strategy moving forwards looks really interesting with the mix of Transavia and Martinair, of course. And then there is, of course, the strategic partnership with Air France. What do you think their strategy is going to be now moving forwards?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that part, because the main problem that Air France KLM had in the past few years, that Air France wasn't making that of profit with respect to KLM. KLM was doing relatively good, and they started their new strategy in transforming 2015 to a restructuring plan. And if you look at in the basic, it is primarily focused on reduction of costs, especially staff. And, last year also they did something with the fuel bill, so that helped. But yeah, Primarily they're looking at to cut the staff costs down. So they're looking at Air France, but also at the K&M part in the Netherlands. So on both sides, they're reducing their, staffing costs.
Yeah.
And that is also pushing them to look differently at their current, everything they have in the holding. They have the Transavia, the Martinair, KLM, of course, in the Netherlands, but also Air France recently, last year, added a hub, the regional activities in France. So they are looking at the whole as a network and what's making profit, but also looking inside the organization to provide, a restructuring and get the profits up. It's the first time in 3 years that Air France made a profit instead of only KLM making a profit.
So. Yeah. Now, they've had troubles recently. We've talked about with Alitalia, and they've had to get their own house in order to do that. But there have been some interesting developments recently on network increases and co-chairing. Let's take the first one that just seemed a bit odd to me, and that is KLM Air France buying a stake in the Brazilian airline Gol.
Well, for Air France and KLM, it's a very interesting market to go into, because primarily they are, taking people between Paris and Amsterdam and to the major cities in Brazil.
Yeah.
And now they can provide also within the continent of South America via Gol. And Gol is also getting the benefits, of course, from the long-haul activities going to Europe.
Yeah.
So in the end, it's a very good partnership they have there, especially, when they want to penetrate the Brazilian and, South American market more than they have at the moment.
Closer to home in the European market, Air Berlin is talking about co-chairing with Air France KLM. And this one really intrigues me because it's unusual because it's a big airline, but it's part of the One World Alliance, whilst Air France is part of the rival group, SkyTeam.
Well, I think Air Berlin, currently they are the second largest in Germany.
Yeah.
And they're primarily focused, of course, on the European continent. So they have a lot of competition from the other major airlines, especially KLM Air France with their inter-Europe network, but also British Airways on the other side.
Yeah.
So Air Berlin already had an agreement with British Airways for certain routes between London and Germany.
Right, okay.
So it's not that different to look at inter-alliance corporation.
Yeah.
It is strange if you think about it, but on the other side, you can't compete with five airlines on the same route, or you just say, well, let's take a co-share agreement and let's divide the profits instead of competing for only, well, say, half of a load factor.
Yeah, true.
That doesn't help.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, Etihad as well, who own 30% of Air Berlin stock. So there is a connection there as well.
Yeah, that's a really large stake. And Etihad is one of the, well, say, the Gulf carriers that is really getting some footing in Europe, but also in the rest of the world, and is really, well, obtaining parts of other airlines.
Yeah.
And normally you would expect it would be a more of a merger or a alliance partnership. For instance, with One World, those types of partnerships. But Etihad is focusing on, well, owning a part and not directly having a co-share agreement. It's more like financial
more projects. Of an investment, yeah.
Yeah, it's an investment. But that's an interesting one because, it's Air Berlin and you can wonder why they did that. But probably it would be also about having certain destinations added from the Middle East to Germany.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they can also get into the German market.
It's an intriguing time for KLM. What do you think they're going to do next in terms of strategic moves? They've moved into South America. They've strengthened their hold in Europe. What's next?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, if you look at what they did last year, they, restructured Martin Air. So that was the first major step, and it was getting the passenger business out.
Yeah.
They moved to the commercial activities for passengers from Martin Air. But also they're reducing their cargo operations. And I think this month, 1st of April, they're also reducing the fleet size from the Martin Air side, but also the KLM side itself. So you're seeing that they're reducing some capacity of cargo activity, but on the other side, they are buying, as a Air France KLM group, they're buying a new fleet of 787s, for instance. So they're also focusing on long-term investment, and with 787, of course, it would be the long-haul market, and, well, still the Chinese market, the Asian market, and especially, well, in this case, the Latin American market, they see some passenger growth over there. So probably they're going to focus on that development in the upcoming years and strengthen that by, adding new types of aircraft to the fleet.
Yeah, it's a exciting time for Air France KLM. I think when we first talked a few years ago on this program, they were in big trouble. Thanks very much for joining us. But before we go, where can we find out about you online?
Yeah, you can find us on aviationplatform.com. That's our website. You can find us on Facebook, so like us. And also we have a LinkedIn group, and we even have a Twitter page. So we're multi-social media oriented.
Well, Frances, thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, let's move on to some listener mail. Let's see. We got this story from a couple of folks, Aaron and Patrick both. We talked about that video where the skydiver, you'll recall, was almost hit by a meteorite. Well, it turns out that some really smart folks have been actually working on this for the last 2 years to try to understand this mystery. We have a link we'll put in the show notes. The bottom line is, you know, it was probably a piece of gravel that got wrapped up in the parachute when it was packed. The story behind this, I don't know if you guys have read this article in theplanetary.org. This is Forensic Ballistics, How Apollo 12 Helped Solve the Skydiver Meteorite Mystery. And it's really a fascinating read, but they did a lot of calculations, a lot of work based off of what they had originally started out doing with Apollo 12 when it landed on the moon and kicked up a lot of debris and stuff. And they needed to, you know, to take some measurements of that. So they used some of that technology plus some other things that NASA had done. But in the end, they were able to estimate the size of the object and the distance from the skydiver. And most likely explanation is that it's not a meteorite, that it was just a little rock, a small stone. So thanks to those guys for sending that in. It's an interesting story. Neil wrote in, and he took me to task. He said, Max, a quick correction to the comment you made in episode 296. The F-35 in the Udvar-Hazy Museum is not a mock-up, which is what I called it. And he says, please see the attached link. And David, well, that's right. You were not there, David, to catch my, sort of slip of the tongue when I called that that a mock-up. It's really not a mock-up at all, is it?
And it's not an F-35 either.
Right.
We need to get this straight.
I was close, though.
You didn't want to say mock-up. You wanted to say prototype.
Right.
And it is the prototype of the X-35C that is actually what became the F-35. And I know that I've forgiven you for this because you spend more time drooling over the engine outside of the airframe than actually looking at the airframe. But the X-35C is claim to fame was it took off vertically, flew supersonic, and landed vertically, which was one of the first aircraft to do it. And it was what won the contest to become the F-35. So yes, it's a historically significant aircraft. It actually flew multiple times. And it's not a mock-up, and you just misspoke, and I wasn't here that night to correct you. So,
and that's a feature of all the aircraft in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, isn't that right, David? That they're all they have some historical significance. They don't just take any old airplane that's old or interesting. it's got to have.
They turn away more aircraft than they have in their collection.
And the really interesting thing, as you mentioned on this one, is that the Stovall version of the F-35 has that lift fan system, and they have that system in front of the aircraft on display there, so you can really get a good view of how that lift fan system works and really how large and extensive it is. It's a great display. I like that one a lot.
And you do need to explain to people that actually is the engine that flew supersonic and did the vertical takeoff. They took it out of the aircraft.
Cool. All right.
So that's not a mock-up either. That's actually a flown engine.
So thanks to Neil for catching me on that. Thank you, David, for giving that great explanation.
Well, and Max, I owe you an apology for that, too, because I knew that was incorrect, and I just didn't want to embarrass you on the show.
I see.
And then I forgot to mention it later, so.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that, Rob, very much.
Yeah, that's okay.
Way to get his back, dude.
Yeah. Trevor sent us a recording about the A-10 Arizona. We talked about this, was it last episode, I think, David? But let's listen to Trevor.
Hello, geeks. I'd like to add a little additional insight to the A-10s in Arizona that I'm sure John McCain wants to save. There is a squadron of A-10s in the Tucson area, which is just south of where the Boneyard is. But in addition to the A-10 squadron there, There's also several A-10 strafing ranges between Phoenix and Tucson out in the middle of the desert. They're actually pretty neat to fly over if you're ever in the area and have nothing else to do besides fly in the middle of the desert. But they're old World War II airfields, the triangle-shaped airfields that they've turned into strafing ranges. And if you're really lucky and have some sort of connection that you can go and see the A-10 strafe, it's pretty neat to see because the A-10s will fly in, and you can Google this and watch it on YouTube, but they'll fly in and you can see the gunfire in the front. You can hear the rounds hit the target, and then you'll hear the rounds fire from the A-10, and then you'll see the air, and then you'll hear and see the A-10 fly by. Really neat experience, but it is a shame that they'll be leaving us, but I think their mission is complete. This is Trevor from at TrevJSmith on Twitter.
All right. Thank you, Trevor. That sounds like quite a sight to see. I'd love to see that.
So the A-10s are leaving us. I wonder if John McCain's going with them.
Well,
that's a terrible thing to say. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I kind of like that comment myself. Very good, Rob.
Okay.
Andy, a UK listener, one of our many UK listeners, wrote and said, thanks for the continuing brilliance of the show and all the hard work you put in. We definitely put a lot of hard work in. Some people think it results in brilliance, and, well, you can decide for yourself, I guess. He says, thanks also for some great guests recently. I particularly liked Hillel Glazier, Fish, and Robin Petgrave. All of them were great, fun, enthusiastic, and full of opinions. We love opinions, which is why we've got Rob. Well, and David, I guess. Let's see, he's got a request. At some point, Max, would you consider doing a piece on some of your favorite engines? He says, maybe a segment on a particular engine now and again, jet or piston, military or civilian. How it works, why it's famous or noteworthy, or why you picked it, and variants and types of aircraft it was or is used in. And he says, and he's giving me some work here, isn't he? And he says, I know this is more work. Oh, here he goes. I know this is more work, and you're already heavily committed with that with the Geeks, UAV Digest, and Pax X. But if you ever get time or know someone else who can do it, I think it'd be really interesting. Thanks again for the great show. So, yeah, interesting idea.
I think you should.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, I'm sorry, but it's a high time you wrote your own segment.
You want to see someone work as hard as you do. That's why.
Well, it ain't ever going to be Rob.
Do you have any? No. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to let you guys bait me.
All right. Well, but you have your minute now. Of course, that's just a minute.
Oh yeah, so. And David's right. It really is a lot of work for something that only might run 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, it's a lot of work.
But yeah, interesting idea. So I'm going to noodle this over. Think of. What might be interesting. I actually have one in mind that's a one-of-a-kind engine, and I happen to know where it is stashed.
Ooh, I like that. That sounds good.
Yeah, I got to see if I can get access to that. So, okay, that's a good idea. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Thanks for the kind words
as well.
You could
call your show As the Blade Turns.
Yes, The Blade Turns. Okay, Antonella wrote in, oh, we talked about e-cigarettes. And, you know, smoking those in the airport, smoking those on the plane, smoking those in places where you're not supposed to smoke tobacco. And Antonella said, as you know, one of the reasons people use e-cigarettes over normal cigarettes is because they can be smoked, quote, anywhere. More and more places are banning e-cig use, though. He says, I decided to take a look into what it's really like trying to use an e-cigarette whilst traveling. After speaking to over 100 airports and airlines, I've just finished putting together this quick tool. The results are quite surprising. So this is called Vapes on a Plane. What's a vape? Rob, you know what a vape is now, right?
Yeah, now I know. It's when you're making vapor. So, okay.
Right. We didn't know. None of us. Did you know what that meant, David? Because Rob didn't,
yes.
And I didn't. You did, huh?
Yes, but we've just, here in Philadelphia, had a big controversy where the city eliminated it from, you are not allowed to use e-cigarettes now in bars and restaurants, etc.
Oh, interesting.
So they banned it. So I was very familiar with the conversation.
So the way this goes is if you use tobacco, it creates smoke, and so you're smoking. But if you use e-cigarettes, it creates vapor, so you're vaping. So anyway, Antonella has got this website up, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes. It's kind of long to say out loud. But basically what you do is you select an airport or an airline, and the site tells you if e-cigarettes are allowed. So that could be fairly handy. And what you find, I just sort of plugged in sort of a random selection of different airlines, different destinations, different airports, and got different kinds of results. Some places they're allowed, some places they are absolutely not allowed. So it's an interesting resource. Put the link to that in the show notes. And Paul sent us a link. This is Pilot's Career Stalls After Criticizing Oxygen System. This is an article in HamptonRoads.com. And it's about the F-22 Raptor pilot who spoke out about the oxygen system problems that were occurring. David, that I guess that's resolved now?
Sort of. I think the last thing I read about it was they were installing additional masks, or they never quite figured out what was causing the issue. So I think they've come up with some several solutions, but I don't think it's ever been resolved satisfactory as what was actually causing the problem.
And this particular pilot, I guess, who spoke out vocally about the problem, according to what's described in this article, suffered some real setbacks in the advancement of his career in the Air Force, leading one to believe that, you know, this was a deliberate action on the part of the Air Force. So we'll put a link to this in the show notes, and you can take a look at that and, reach your own conclusion. It's like being a whistleblower, you know, except that you're in the Air Force, so you're not protected.
Yeah, there should be some sort of protection, but these things happen.
Yeah, and military's kind of tough. I mean, there's chain of command, there's, you know, You need it's a strong control and command kind of an environment, and you need to maintain that, right? But
But sometimes you also need to send up the red flag saying there's a problem.
Yeah, it's a tough issue. Well, hopefully maybe this will spark some conversations that, you know, kind of bring some sort of a good resolution to that issue. All right, we heard from Moshe, who writes, "Dear Geeks, I love your show and listen to it religiously."
I think that's Moshe, isn't it? Moshe?
He's from Israel. In fact, he works for El Al. He's, a manager or in customer relations in El Al. He says, "I'd like to respond to Rob's Aviation Minute segment concerning TSA pre-check." He says, "I don't purport to reply on behalf of the TSA, but I believe your suggestion that they allow random passengers to fly through the pre-check lane without removing their shoes, belts, etc., would not be possible to implement from a security standpoint." He says the whole idea behind the pre-check program is that you have already been pre-screened and found to pose no threat. Based on the background check performed, the TSA is willing to relax their standards a bit, but let you through with your shoes and belt on, with your laptop in its case, etc. However, the random passengers who are sent by TSA staff to the pre-check lane to whet their appetite for pre-check membership have not been pre-screened. They pose the same threat level as anyone else and would therefore need to complete the more stringent security screening process. It says, keep up the great work, and I look forward to this week's episode.
To which I actually responded an email to him and said, you know what? I never even thought of that part. I mean, that's a really, really interesting point that we're just grabbing people that we really don't screen the same way as everybody else, and we let them through.
It is amazing.
I honestly never thought of that. So thank you, Moshe, for passing that on.
And it does happen. I mean, I was listening to one of Leo Laporte's podcasts and just recently, and he was talking about they were talking about actually observing that. Just pull people out of the line and send them into the pre-check line and, you know, and just let them go on through. That seems like a really dangerous thing to do.
Well, and on top of what we talked about last week, they don't even tell people what to do. They just say, hey, you've been selected for the pre-check. Yeah. Over this way. And they go, oh, okay.
Right.
And they have no clue what to do.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really want to thank our guest, Mekay Beeler, for coming on the show. You can find her at a bunch of places, maykaybeeler.com. She's also on Facebook, Mekay Beeler, and that's M-A-Y-C-A-Y-B-E-E-L-E-R. Also on Twitter, Make Hay Beeler.
No, I think it's two E's.
How many did I say?
You said E-E-E. I think it's just...
I got an extra E, huh? I'm just so excited.
Sorry, Make Hay.
Okay. We want to thank our contributors, Graham McCare and Steve Vischer. Find them at playingcrazydownunder.com. We'd also like to thank Peter Johnson. You can find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, cool. Jetwine on Twitter, jetwine.com on the blog, which is also where they're going to find the Aviation Minute and the archive for the Aviation Minute. Places on Facebook, also at AIN Safety, and that's probably enough for now.
Good. David Vanderhoof, where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Google Plus. You can find me on Friday mornings with my co-host Max Flight on the very quickly growing UAV Digest.
All right. Yeah, we are growing pretty quickly. We've got a great audience, involved audience, just like we do here. It's really gratifying. So, again, I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter is Max Flight, along with David on Fridays at the UAVDigest.com. Also at RunwayGirlNetwork.com for the PAXX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes for this episode at AirplaneGeeks.com. Or if you want to go straight to this episode, AirplaneGeeks.com/297. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com and on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message. And our favorite Aunt Benet has something to say.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEK-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Not just to do with football and the World Cup, then?
Well, probably a bit. Maybe the board directors.
Yes, a giant non-event grant. And speaking of things that we thought might be a non-event, let's talk about another announcement that the Prime Minister made this week, talking about buying more F-35s for the Royal Australian Air Force, a further 58, in fact.
Hang on, I thought we were going with the hijack.
Oh, shit. Oh, yes.
Rewind.
Oh, I clicked the wrong tab. What a d***.
You were wondering how I worked that one in, right?
Yes. Yeah, I know. I was trying to think, how did we do that again?
Vanderhoof, where do people find you?
Right now, comatose.
Aunt Benet from aviationqueen.com has something or other to say. I'm trying to go through this too fast.
Well, did you say that your husband is a test pilot for Honda?
Yeah, well, my ex, my then husband. Yeah, my baby dad. That's okay. Awkward.
Oh,
way to go, Robert.